This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Stay tuned now for this.
Moorish. Orthodox. Radio. Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
Mala de
To the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg. We're opening up with the Balls of Bengal, which are they were a cast of traditional minstrels, street musicians, recorded probably on location in Calcutta back in the 1960s. I don't even know what label. It was taped from the personal collection of a friend, so you'll have a hard time finding it. So I'm not even going to bother with any of that. Maybe we'll hear some more of it later tonight. But we're honored to be joined by Amarish Misra, who is the author of a rather hefty two-volume book of around, 2,000 pages, is it?
Yes.
Entitled War of Civilizations, India, A.D. 1857. Welcome aboard, Amarish Misra.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So, you've been on tour promoting your book?
Yeah.
Which is published in India.
Yeah.
Where it's occasioned a certain degree of controversy, I understand.
Yeah.
Basically, it's taking a second look at the Indian mutiny, or the Sepoy revolt, as it's sometimes called.
Yeah.
Of 1857,
mm-hmm.
and you're basically arguing, from what I can gather, shamefully, I have not had time to read the 2,000 pages of your book, but because I found out that you were in town a rather short order, but
yeah.
Apparently you believe that this was the first European Holocaust.
Yeah, I mean, the first Holocaust of the world, I mean, caused by a European power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, because
and the death tolls have been downplayed by history, dramatically underestimated.
Absolutely, because the British actually they never really put a figure to how many Indians were killed in the 1857 wars, which went on till 1867 for a period of 10 years. They did calculate roughly the number of Indian soldiers who were killed, but they did not take into account the civilian revolutionaries and the common people who were killed, you know. And so I think I did something which was long overdue, and which someone had to say someday. I mean, it was very tough because there were almost no records and the records that were there were kind of scattered, because even Indian historians after independence, I think they preferred not to kind of, you know, touch this very, very sensitive subject.
Mm. Well, why is it sensitive today after all of these years?
You see, because we have to go back to the nature of Indian independence in 1947, because India gained independence. It was like a full and final independence. But there was a significant colonial component that was retained. I mean, after all, India did not see the kind of revolution which one sees when a foreign power is driven away, like one saw in Vietnam or one saw in, so many other colonial theaters. It was more a transfer of power, which meant that the British basically went away, but the new Indian leadership, the new post-independence Indian leadership, retained a lot of colonial institutions. And 1857 was, also somehow, because it was a violent uprising, it was a peasant uprising, and India, I mean, liked to kind of believe that it gained independence through Mahatma Gandhi's nonviolence. So there were various factors, which kind of coalesced to prevent the full scope of 1857 ever being brought out. I have evidence that in 1957, 100 years after the event, when the 100th anniversary of 1857 was being celebrated, the British government actually sanctioned money for the British embassies both in India and Pakistan to actually lobby for, to downplay the event. And then a very surprising fact has come to light that the Indian historian, whose name was S.N. Sen, who was officially commissioned to write a history of 1857 in 1957 by Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, who was India's prime minister back then, when he went to London to research, he was actually trailed by the MI6. And this has come out recently, some British scholars who have access now to the MI6, declassified papers. So, why was the MI6 trailing a historian? Because 1857 was, it was something which actually I think the British never really forgave India for, because 1857 robbed the British of this great evangelical mission which so many Christian missionaries were thinking about of converting Indians. It robbed it robbed the British of because 1857 ended the rule of East India Company, which was a private company ruling India. So it was, in a way, one of the earliest blows to corporate fascism. So, in 1857, basically, Indians fought against a marriage of corporate imperialist fascism and evangelical, missionaries. There was a marriage between the two. And this great project of the then greatest Western power, the then greatest Western Christian power, was literally halted. Because after 1857, you find that everywhere the concept of a private corporate ruling nations recedes. The Dutch East India Company fades into the background. The French East India Company loses its. And also you find that the whole project of Western imperialism converting the people, they colonized, like the like Spanish imperialism converted people of Latin America, and British imperialism converted people of Africa. This entire thing stopped after 1857, and so it was a kind of a turning point and a big setback.
Okay, well, there's a lot of ground we could cover here, but we should probably note for the listeners that this is, the 1857 revolt formally marked the end of the independent Mughal Empire in India and the beginning of direct British rule. So I'm not quite sure I see how it was a setback exactly for the British.
No, I mean, it ended the rule of the East India Company because, like you yourself said, that the British were not ruling directly until 1857. They were ruling through a private corporate company,
right?
Like the East India Company. So it was almost like a Coca-Cola ruling an African nation today. You know, it's almost like that. I mean, if you can envision such a thing happening today, then that is the kind of parallel that would come to my mind. Or maybe Halbert or some other company.
Well, the parallels are pretty obvious, actually.
Perhaps
with a certain degree of exaggeration, you could draw a parallel to the situation with Shell Oil in Nigeria.
Absolutely. That's a very, very, very apt comparison. So somewhere along the line, there was this East India Company, which was basically colonizing and draining wealth from India in the name of free trade, free markets, that entire thing about tying India to a global economy. Nowadays we hear a lot about globalization. It's not a new term. If you see, if you study the 19th century documents, you will find that the East India Company basically believed in globalization. It believed in colonizing and then globalizing economies. So it was a setback because, after that revolt, when direct British rule came into being, the East India Company's rule was abolished. Queen Victoria, she had to issue a proclamation on 1st November 1858, guaranteeing Indians freedom of religion, non-interference in religion, guaranteeing that Europeans will not interfere in Indian customs, culture and religions. And then we find a reversal of the free trade economic policies. British rule, between 1757, which was the Battle of Plassey, after which the British started conquering India step by step, between 1757 and 1857, we find a period where the entire Indian indigenous capitalist growth is killed. India is deindustrialized, and a lot of wealth is actually drained from India, which goes up to between 100 million and 150 million pounds a year. And a lot of that wealth actually finances England's industrial revolution. But after 1857, you find that slowly an Indian bourgeoisie starts growing, that Indians are they start taking initiatives in establishing their own industries. So 1857 actually allowed all that to happen. And the freedom movement of Mahatma Gandhi could become successful only because of the backing of a substantial section of the Indian bourgeoisie, which had before 1857 had been killed, and there were no conditions for it to kind of evolve. But after 1857, the British had to issue some kind of a protection. They had to go into a kind of a quasi protectionist direction. And they had to allow some Indian entrepreneurs they had to give them space. Restrictions on unfettered globalization the British government it started regulating unfettered.
All right. Well, we should go through the mechanics of how this actually works. Okay. Yeah. Prior to 1857, India was still sort of officially independent under the Mughal emperor.
Yeah.
But it was sort of, as you describe it, sort of corporate colonization by the East India.
This is a test of New York City's emergency alert system. This is only a test. In the event of a real emergency, this system could be used to deliver important information. This test of New York City's emergency alert system is now complete.
Okay, are we back on the air yet? Is the implication that we're back on the air? That was certainly rather annoying. Okay, if this had been an actual emergency, we would probably all be dead at this point. So thank goodness that wasn't an actual emergency. Where were we? Oh, yes, India, 1857. We're speaking with Amarish Misra, who is the author of a book, War of Civilizations, India, A.D., 1857. Two volumes, around 1,000 pages each. So, okay, as we were just saying, but prior to 1857, India was still ostensibly being ruled by the Mughal Empire, as it had been for several centuries.
Yeah.
By this point, the empire was in a state of decay, and the British had certain ports which they had established as protectorates, I believe Calcutta and Madras being the...
And Bombay, yeah.
Being the most significant ones. But still, India as a whole was ostensibly independent, mostly under the Mughals, and there were some smaller states as well. But in all cases, the British East India Company was sort of the real power behind the throne, and had actually established its own military force. It was actually the troops of this military force which revolted in 1857. So why don't you talk first about the circumstances of that? What actually brought about the revolt?
Actually, of course, there were like various factors, but I will start with the most important one, and that is that the sepoys. I mean, the sepoys were the soldiers of the army which the British East India Company created.
Now, what does the word sepoy actually mean?
Sepoy actually it you know, the British used to refer a private as a you know, they used to call a private a sepoy.
Mm.
Basically, I think it came from the French. Because the French East India Company was also in the 18th century, 100 years before 1857, they were competing with the British East India Company for influence in India.
The French were.
Yeah, the French. In fact, I mean, there was a time when even the Dutch were there.
Right.
But the Dutch
Portuguese
left. The Dutch left, and the French also lost, and they left. And so the sepoy army and the British... they formed three sepoy armies. They formed one army for the Bengal Presidency, which was the largest presidency, and they formed one for the Bombay Presidency, and they formed one for the Madras Presidency.
All right, now, presidency, were these the administrative units of the East India Company?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. These were the administrative units of the East India Company. The Bengal President, North and Central and East India, came under the Bengal Presidency, West India came under the Bombay Presidency, and South India came under the Madras Presidency. Mm. So the soldiers in the Bengal Presidency army, was the largest army. It was manned by British officers who were specially trained in an academy based in Addiscombe in England, and they were an elite corps. Because no Indian could become actually even a junior officer. The highest post for an Indian was that of a Havaldar, which is equal to, I think, a deputy sergeant or something. So that was the highest post an Indian could rise to. The entire officer corps was British. In the artillery, I mean, there were three sections. There was the infantry, there was the cavalry, and there was the artillery. And the British made it a point since the beginning to employ the least number of Indians in the artillery because they believed that whoever held artillery held India. So basically now this army, this Bengal army, it was the largest army among the three presidency army. It numbered around about 130,000, which is about 130,000 soldiers. And the British used this army not just to conquer different states in India. They also used it to suppress the Taiping revolt in China. They also sent it to Singapore. They sent it to Hong Kong. They sent it to Burma, you know, during the Anglo-Burmese War. They sent it to Nepal. They sent it to even to Persia. Parts of the army were also sent to some European theater of the war, like the Crimean War. So this was. I mean, the British were proud of the Bengal Sepoy Army because they thought that they had created the most efficient killing machine then known in Asia, and a large section of Europe which was close to Asia. I mean, this army was also sent to Persia. But the interesting thing is that soldiers of this army came from an area known as which is present day Uttar Pradesh, which is India's most populous province, and which is called the heartland, like you call the Bible Belt in America, the heartland of America. In the same way, Uttar Pradesh and Bihar, these two states, they are called, still called the heartland of India because they set the tone for Indian politics and culture. So these soldiers came from this, very ancient area of the Indo-Gangetic plains, and this area was the bastion of great ancient empires in the past, and it was also the bastion of the Mughal Empire. So the soldiers who came from this area, who were both Hindus and Muslims, they actually thought that, since the East India Company was ruling in the name of Bahadur Shah Zafar, who was the last Mughal emperor.
Yeah.
They actually thought that when their fathers also that when they were conquering India and parts of Asia for the East India Company, that the East India Company was a servant of the Mughal Emperor. This is what was told to them, and they believed that.
And okay, but just to clarify points here, the army was under the command of the British Army, or it had some sort of bureaucratic distance from the British Army?
No, it was not under the command of the British Army. It was under the command of British officers.
Right. But officers from the British Army?
Not officers from the British Army. Officers specially trained to be officers of the Bengal Sepoy Army. They were trained specially for this purpose in a place called Addis Combe. Mm. In London, there was an academy which was specially made where officers were sent to basically direct these armies.
It was administratively distinct from the British Army.
Yeah, the British also had their army,
right,
which was then called the Her Majesty's Squadrons and Battalions. Mm. And at the time of 1857, the British had about 42,000. Pure British army, which were like British regiments, mm-hmm. which were brought. So they were also there. Mm-hmm. They were also there in India, and they were spread out mainly in North India, mm-hmm. Which was also the center of the Bengal Sepoy Army. So these two were distinct, entities, so as to say. The Bengal Army soldier, in 1856, actually, quite a few of the Bengal Army soldiers, as I said, came from Uttar Pradesh. And within Uttar Pradesh, there's an area of 12 districts called Awadh. And this area of Awadh was almost a kind of a quasi-independent kingdom till 1856 when it was annexed. And the British were like annexing, autonomous Indian kingdoms, and they had started annexing them from 1799 onwards. The annexation of Awadh in 1856 really hit the Sepoys hard because because that was their state. And then after that...
Okay, and it was annexed...
In 1856.
In what sense was it annexed?
The ruler, Wais Ali Shah, was removed from the throne, and it was made directly a part of British India. You see, at that time, India was divided into two sections, British India and Princely India. And Princely India was a place which was ruled by princes who had made alliances with the British, and the idea was that they will have the power to govern over their subjects, but the British will protect their frontiers. That they will not have a strong army, basically. So the British were on a policy that those princes who were opposing them, they used to annex those states. And those princes who entered into an alliance with them, which was called the subsidiary alliance system, which is quite similar to what Americans are doing now, that stationing troops in certain countries and asking those countries to pay for those troops. So they used to do the same thing. It was a subsidiary alliance where the British used to send their supply army, or they used to create a special contingent. There was a state called Gwalior where the British created a special Gwalior contingent of manned by British, exactly along the same lines as the Bengal Sepoy Army, but it was paid by the Prince of Gwalior. When Awadh was annexed in 1856,
and it was annexed with what justification?
It was annexed with the same justification. You'll be surprised. Arguments which are very, very similar to ones given, before the Iraq War, that Awadh is being mismanaged, that its ruler has designs to topple the British the British Empire, that the people are not satisfied, the ruler. He's oppressing. He's a tyrant. So these were
So the British took it over and actually turned it into part of British ruled India.
Absolutely.
All right, they did this through the British Army or through the East India Army?
Through the East India Army.
Okay.
Through the East India Army, and when the annexation was happening, the East Indian Army, the Bengal Army sepoys, they went to Wajid Ali Shah, who was the last ruler of Awadh. And the British knew of this, and they went to Wais Ali Shah and they said that if you order us to fight, we will fight right now. But Wais Ali Shah said, no, don't fight right now, because the entire plan which was being hatched with the help of Bahadur Shah Zafar in Delhi and other Indian princes, it had not matured. So he said he stopped them. But it shows that the sepoys were ready, even at that time, to fight.
To fight against the British.
Against the British.
Turn the guns on their masters.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so Wais Ali Shah himself stopped them. So then after that, then you see a movement, where you find that Bahadur Shah Zafar is sending emissaries to sepoys and saying that you think that East India Company is my servant, but my servant has turned into a master, and now I am their servant. My rule does not extend beyond the Red Fort. So these kind of messages were being carried to Indian cantonments by fakirs, by sadhus, and by Muslim maulvis, by Hindu sadhus and Muslim maulvis, who are all itinerant, preachers, basically, and religious people, and who had access to these cantonments because...
Okay, what's a cantonment?
Cantonment was a place where the army was stationed. And it was always in a city, quite a distance removed from the city, which was almost on the outskirts of the city, any city. Religious preachers were allowed there because the sepoys were Hindus and Muslims. India was a religious country, and the British, till the 1850s, they deferred to the religious sentiments of the sepoys. So these preachers, they started carrying out these these messages. Then they started, telling the sepoys that there is a plot to convert you, basically,
to Christianity.
Exactly. And this was a period when a lot of you see a lot of evangelical activity in India. A lot of priests, not just from England, but from Germany, from various other Protestant countries, they descend on India and they start conducting these public debates with Muslim clerics, with Hindus. And there is this famous Agra debate which took place in the city of Agra where Taj Mahal is, which is called the Agra debate in 1853, where the British missionary called Fander, he debated for like a week with a Muslim religious leader called Maulvi Karanvi. And it's very interesting because Maulvi Karanvi was supported by Dr. Wazir Khan, who was a trained surgeon, who had gone to England and who had, he was a doctor, and he was an allopathic doctor. But he came back and he when he saw the attack on Islam, he stepped forward, to defend his religion against.
And right. When you say the attack on Islam, you mean by missionaries?
Absolutely, yeah. By missionaries, and it is very interesting because today we have a paradigm where the West somehow thinks that Islam is a religion of faith, and that the West has the power of rationality. At that time, it's so surprising, in 1853, the argument between missionary Fander and Dr. Wazir Khan and Maulvi Karanvi, if you see that, Fander is arguing on the basis of faith, and Dr. Wazir Khan, who has been to Europe, who has been to London, Dr. Wazir Khan is aware of the young Hegelian movement led by Richard Strauss and Bruno Bayer, who are actually saying that the Gospels are nothing but stories. So he is basically taking a very, very left Hegelian rational argument.
And how is he applying this to Islam?
He was applying this to Islam because he was attacking the concept of Trinity in Christianity as irrational.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that Islam believes in one God,
mm-hmm.
that it does not split the unity of God into three,
mm-hmm.
and that is more rational than the concept of Trinity,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that Christianity regards Jesus not as a Messiah, which the Muslim because the Muslims also
Christianity does regard him as a Messiah.
Yeah, no, Christianity regard him as a son of God.
Yes.
But Muslims say that, he was our prophet also,
yes.
because Muslims regard Jesus as a prophet.
Yes.
But not as a God,
mm-hmm.
not as a son of God.
Right.
So that was because that was blasphemy that no human being can be the son of God.
Mm-hmm.
So he was basically attacking Christianity on the basis of rationality.
Okay, so how did all of this lead to the 1857 revolt?
Because all this created a lot of apprehension and a lot of nervous excitement amongst the sepoys, because these were open debates being held in cities where sepoys used to come in their spare time to visit the courtesan quarters, to listen to music. Courtesans. They were like the geishas of India, and to entertain themselves. And they used to come to the bazaars, and they heard all this, all this buzz that big debates are happening, and they had never heard this before. Because India was basically a country where two religions, Islam and Hinduism, coexisted. For a long time, the Mughals were famous for their tolerance and for their broad secularism. So they had never heard of something like this, and this created a lot of apprehension. And there are instances where several sepoys went back to their cantonment and they complained to their British officers that such and such thing is happening, and why is this happening? But the British officers, they just brush it away. They don't worry. It's just two people debating. Don't. But the Sipahis were not convinced. And slowly and steadily, this perception grew that somehow the British, in the Bengal army earlier, the bond between the British officer and the Indian soldier was very strong. I mean, it used to be said in Asia that this combination of the British officer corps and the Indian soldier can beat any army in the world. So there was a bond. But then after 1853, and when this bond started, it began to grow weak. And then we also see a kind of a puritanical backlash amongst the British officers, because earlier they used to mix with Indian soldiers, they used to attend the courtesan quarters, but then suddenly, missionaries started encouraging wives to come to the cantonments, and these wives were very, very puritanical, and the missionaries also, they started, there was a virtual ban that no British officer could visit a courtesan quarter or wrestle with his soldiers or actually be very pally with the soldiers. So all this was happening and then rumors started floating that somehow the British wanted to interfere with the religion of Hindus.
Okay,
and
Muslims. What is the truth or lack of thereof of the apocryphal story that we've all heard about the grease which was used in the rifles, which was either from cows or from pigs, and therefore offensive to either Hindus or Muslims?
Actually, I unearthed a letter which is there in I think. Chapter four of the first volume of my book, which was written by a British officer to a fellow officer in a military station called Raniganj, which was close to Calcutta. Now this is a letter of 22nd January 1857, mm-hmm. And when rumblings in the Raniganj cantonment they start about the British using these grease cartridges, because cow was sacred to Hindus,
right.
And pork was considered haram, or
yes.
it was forbidden for Muslims. So these rumors had started circulating. And this British officer is writing to his fellow officer, and he says that I think that the middlemen, a lot of middlemen who supply, because at that time the new Enfield rifle was coming into being. It was being introduced to India. Earlier you had the Brown Bess musket, in which there was no need to bite the cartridge. Sepoys, they had a pouch and they had gunpowder and they had bullets, mm-hmm. where they used to put the gunpowder in the bullet and they used to fire at one time, one at a time. With the Enfield rifle, the gunpowder and everything was put in one cartridge, and you had to bite that cartridge, from your mouth. And because beef and pork was cheaper.
Right. Well, that's the famous story. So you're saying that there actually this was a,
this happened. Yeah.
This was a significant cause of the revolt.
Absolutely. Okay. Because we have the letter of a British officer saying that the cartridge is greased with greased with cow and pig fat, and that it seems as if people who supply, who used to supply the grease that because goat grease or other it was costly,
mm-hmm.
so they started doing this with beef and pork. But the amazing thing is that the British, who were so mindful of Indian religious sentiments, the Bengal Sepoy army was created way back in 1758. And they were very, very, particular, the British officers, about Indian religious sentiments. Even then, if that was the case, how, and if they knew this, then, how did they allow it? So there was this, thinking in the Indian sepoys that, something has gone terribly wrong with our relationship. that that there is something really. And then you know, there was this annexation of Awadh. There were these letters coming from Bahadur Shah Zafar that the Mughal Empire will, in any case, the British will end the Mughal Empire after my death. That I am a prisoner of the British. So all these things combined, you know, and a kind of a very, very nervous excitement was created. Now, you have to remember one more thing, that most of these sepoys, they were peasants. They were farmers. I mean, they were not peasants in the Western sense, in the sense that they were not serfs or something, because India didn't have that European type of landlordism or feudalism. But they were peasants, you know, they belonged to rural communities. Because in India, basically, farming was communitarian in nature. So they came from that background. They came from the village. And they also saw that the British were introducing a new land revenue system, that they were extracting three-fourths of the land revenue, and that the Mughals used to, you know, only tax like one-fifth, you know.
Okay, so the British were doing this in the areas that they directly ruled.
Exactly, exactly. And they had annexed Awadh in 1856. Mm. So the Awadhian sepoys had, you know, they did not feel the pinch till 1856. But after 1856, suddenly they realized that you know, they also had to pay more land revenue. They had lost their privileged position of being part of a state which was independent of the British. So, you know, there was you know, there were these sentiments. And then which is a very, very crucial date, that on 31st March 1857, a sepoy named Mangal Pandey, who was a Brahmin, and Brahmin are the highest castes in India. And the British were again very particular about admitting the higher castes in the Bengal army. So Mangal Pandey, he was something happened. He was taunted by a few, and he just charged at a British officer, and he managed to injure two of them, and the British officers they basically ordered other Indian sepoys to stop him, but the Indian sepoys for the first time they did not react.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, and then Mangal Pandey of course was overpowered and he was hanged. But then, I mean, he was hanged on 8th April. But then that entire incident, you know, it started a chain of reaction, which ultimately led to the revolt of the 3rd Bengal Cavalry on 10th May at Meerut, which is about 120 kilometers from Delhi. And the sepoys revolted, and the cavalry revolted, then the infantry followed. And all of them went to Delhi, and by 11th May, they had crowned Bahadur Shah Zafar. They had killed all the British in Delhi, and they had crowned Bahadur Shah Zafar as the emperor. I mean, they sort of recrowned Bahadur Shah Zafar as India's emperor, and they proclaimed the end of the rule.
What do you mean they recrowned him? He was sent to exile in Burma, wasn't he?
No, he was exiled when Delhi fell to the British.
Yes, yes.
Till 1857, till 10th May 1857, he was still formally, India's emperor, and the East India Company was ruling India on his behalf, technically.
All right. So what do you mean he was recrowned?
He was because the sepoys said that, now we abolished the East India Company. We are now going to.
Oh, so he was recrowned by the mutineers.
Exactly. Oh, he was recrowned by what we call the revolutionaries.
Yes.
The British call the mutineers.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, you know, and these peasant soldiers, and they, you see, because when East India Company was ruling, they used to proclaim that the universe is God's, the land is king's. And the order of the company runs, but the sepoys, they changed it to the universe is God's, the rule is that of the king, but the order is of the sepoys.
Mm-hmm.
So you know and then what happened, you know, something amazing. Then there was that action of recrowning Bahadur Shah Zafar by the sepoys. It set off this amazing peasant upheaval, where everywhere peasants, they started attacking landlords who had been put into place by the British, because as I said before, India did not have a European type of feudalism. But when the British came, and from 1757 onwards, they created they reinvented, you know, European feudalism on Indian soil. And so immediately in 1857, it, you know, became a peasant war, because the peasantry started attacking the landlords put into the villages by the British.
All right, and now we're starting to get into the part which is sort of left out by the official histories.
Yeah, absolutely, because you see a situation where a poor peasant, you know, because the pattern was to liberate district after district, and wherever they could find a person of princely descent, they placed him formally on the local throne with an overall national allegiance to Bahadur Shah Zafar, the Mughal emperor. But at several places there was no one from a princely descent, so the peasants themselves, they proclaimed one of their own as the ruler of that area, ruling on behalf of Bahadur Shah Zafar. Mm-hmm. So you had a revolution where the peasantry and the urban proletariat, so as to say, they upstaged the men of property, and they assumed power. And this was really, really frightening, not just to the British, but also to the Indian elite built and nurtured by the British for the past 100 years almost. And so that is why 1857 became a class war by the end of it, you know, because like in a city like Delhi, where the British entered Delhi in 1803. And by 1857, they had established their own set of elite, you know, in the city. But when the sepoys descended on Delhi, you know, it was almost like a peasant army invading Delhi. And the Delhi elite, they got really, really scared, because the sepoys took away the best of courtesans. They started a peasant carnival of their own. It was, I mean, if you read those scenes, it is almost like the Spanish Civil War, when the anarchists or the peasant revolution, when they used to capture a town, they used to turn it into a kind of a festival, a peasant carnival, you know. So where all the men of property were either, you know, they were ridiculed, and they were, you know. So it was a similar scene there. And that is, you know, and that is one major reason why 1857 was not just a war of independence, it was also a class war. It was a peasant war.
Okay, so how did the British react?
The British reacted in two ways. They were taken aback at first because they swore by the loyalty of the Bengal army sepoys. They never thought, I mean, this is what they said, that they never thought that they would revolt. In several stations, British officers still, they just couldn't believe that the Bengal army sepoy could revolt. But when station after station, when cantonment after cantonment started revolting, you know, one by one, then the British, then they thought of putting together a European force. And they said that, you know, one decisive defeat of the Indian sepoys, because the British were of the opinion that the Indians, they don't know how to, I mean, you know, because they had not allowed Indians to, you know, go beyond the post of a deputy sergeant. So they said that an Indians under the British had commanded at most a platoon, you know. So the British were confident that Indians will not be able to act as officers. They will not be able to, direct a whole regiment in a regular battle. So with this confidence, they called European forces from the Punjab, and a battle took place on 30th June 1857 in a village called Chinhat, which is between Lucknow, which is called Lucknow, which was the capital of Awadh. And that is a decisive battle because the British army was led by Henry Lawrence, who was the number two man then. He was next to Governor General Canning, and he was a war hero. I mean, you know, he had fought earlier in the Crimean War, And so Henry Lawrence faced an army of sepoys, and he was taken aback because in that battle, the sepoys, they defeated the British by using, you know, European tactics. They led a very disciplined charge, and they outflanked Henry Lawrence, and they outflanked him from both the left and the right. And this kind of a move, I mean, even Henry Lawrence had not taught them, because the British basically, I mean, the conventional idea then was to outflank from either the left or the right. But the sepoys, the way they moved, and this was, remember, this was a battle being fought in the open plains, you know, so they outflanked Henry Lawrence's army from both sides, and Henry Lawrence was killed, and the British were defeated, and the sepoys, they captured Lucknow. The capture of Lucknow after Delhi sent shockwaves throughout Europe, because the British said that, you know, I mean, the British army had, I mean, it was like had Americans lost the Battle of Baghdad. The shock was that great, because the British army had never been defeated before. I mean, since the Napoleonic Wars, they had never been defeated. Even during the Crimean War with Russia, which was fought in 1854-1855, even then they had suffered some reverses, but ultimately they were able to prevail. So they had never imagined that they will lose, and that too in an Asiatic theater. So that was, you know, and then after the Battle of Chinar, they also lost the Battle of Shahganj in Agra. They also lost the Battle of Kanpur. So all these defeats, you know, it really shook the British. And then they reacted by because they felt that the sepoys have a cause, while the British army it doesn't have a cause. You know, sepoys are fighting a kind of a patriotic battle, a battle for their class interests. But the British army doesn't have a cause to rally to. So slowly a kind of a plot emerged where, in the Battle of Kanpur, a lot of British women and children were, after the men were killed, a lot of British women and children were kept in the prison by Nana Sahib, who was a leader of the Kanpur revolt. And so as the British army started approaching Kanpur, and you know, there was a plot, there's a very murky plot, you know, which I've tried to unravel in chapter 12 of my book, where actually the British tried, those 150 women and children were killed, and the British put the blame on Nana Sahib. You know, it's almost like 9/11, and Nana Sahib was involved in battling the British army, which was approaching Kanpur.
All right, so you're saying that they were actually killed by forces in league with the British, and it was a sort of a false flag operation, so to speak.
Absolutely, because you know why? Because I analyzed the British charges, you know, the specific British charges, and I was surprised that when the British reached that spot where that murder had supposedly taken place, a lot of things were planted after the British army.
Okay,
arrived.
So this proved to be something of a turning point.
It proved to be something
okay,
of a
so
turning
what
point.
What happened next?
Because it rallied. Suddenly the British army had a cause that they had killed our women and children, and that, you know, and there were various other stations where a lot of British civilians were besieged. So the cry was, you know, and basically this was used. The Kanpur incident was used to rally more forces from England, because at that time in England, Lord Palmerston was the Prime Minister. He was a Whig. You know, at that time you had the Tories and the Whigs. So he was a Whig and Queen Victoria. So they were unsure about the prospect of this war. But after the Kanpur incident, we suddenly find that British troops, wherever they are in the world, whether they are in, you know, fighting in China, and I'm talking about, you know, proper British regiments, not the sepoy mm-hmm, armies. Mm-hmm. So whether they are fighting in China or they are fighting in Persia, all these forces are being called to the Indian theater.
Okay. All right. I should say that it's 1:00 in the morning on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg, and we are speaking with Amaresh Misra, who is discussing his book, his massive two-volume book, War of Civilizations, India, AD 1857, about the so-called Sepoy Mutiny. Okay, and we're getting to just the most, we've just a half an hour left, and I've got a lot of points I'd like to take up with you, so let's try to keep it rocking along here. We're getting exactly to the point where the most controversial point in your book is, where you say that over the course of the next 10 years, mostly rural revolts, I suppose, yeah, all over India,
yeah,
are put down by the British at a cost of some 10 million lives.
Yeah.
Okay, so can we... What are your sources for this? Because, I mean, traditionally we're told, you know, the standard history books say that the so-called Sepoy Mutiny was put down at a cost of around 100,000 lives, mostly of Sepoys, not of civilians. So what are your sources for a figure of 10 million overwhelmingly civilians?
Yeah, actually, this is, the part played by the civilian population was actually, you know, it remained suppressed till 100 years later. It was only in 1957 when some Indian historians started bringing out. I mean, there was a book by an Indian historian called S.B. Chaudhary, and the title of the book was Civil Rebellions in 1857. He specifically named the book Civil Rebellion because he wanted to show that apart from the Sepoy mutinies, there were these civil rebellions all over India, and where a lot of civilians and, you know, especially the peasantry they took part. Now, of course, the British, they did not leave any records of these. But you know, I belong to Uttar Pradesh, and there are a lot of other people. India's first prime minister, if you recall, Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, he has written in his memoirs that he, because he also grew up in Allahabad, which is a town in Uttar Pradesh, that when he was growing up, he used to hear these horror stories from his teacher, who used to teach him Urdu, from his servants, and they used to tell him about this wiping out of entire villages, and he has written this in his memoirs, in Discovery of India, and you know, other books. I mean, he was an intellectual politician. So I have also grown up, and you know, if you go to Uttar Pradesh, Bihar, and other states of North and Central India, and even West India, you will find that in the villages, even now, there are a lot of stories about British atrocities. So I always had this in mind that when I will write a book on 1857, I will try to get to the, you know, to the bottom of this, you know, I will try to put a figure to how many civilians were killed. And then it was by a stroke of, you know, luck that I came across documents in the PWD department. PWD is the Public Works Department, which has stored a lot of material on road and rail construction in India, and this material goes back to the British era. Now there I found district reports and district surveys being done by British officers 20, 30 years after the revolt, say in the 1870s and the 1880s, when say a British officer, a British civil officer, he is trying to build a road in one of the towns of Awadh, but he's not finding labor, you know. And then he starts calculating, and he picks up figures from the old records, the old Persian records, when Awadh was an independent state, because they had extensive records, and so he starts comparing that what was the population of this area in 1856, mm-hmm, and what is the population now, mm-hmm, and then almost in all the 12 Awadh districts, there is this thing that there is a 20-25% drop in the population.
Okay, but there were lots of famines during this period.
No, but you know, if you see the history of famines, in the areas I'm talking about, there was no famine between 1857 and 1878 when this officer is writing. In 1871, there was a famine, but in South India. In this area, principally UP and Bihar, the last major famine was 1831.
All right, so you're arguing this was due to massacres?
Due to massacres, absolutely. Then we have another...
At the hands of the British Army.
Mm. I went to the post office department in the state of Uttar Pradesh, and there I found that they have a lot of archival material, and there I found letters where in the 1870s a British post office general he's writing to his junior that there are these 2.5 million, I mean, this is the exact figure, the 2.5 million letters which are lying, and these are all letters which did not find their addresses in Awadh.
Mm-hmm.
And they all belong to the period of the mutiny.
Mm-hmm.
And just get rid of them. Because he says that it seems that our boys did a very good job of killing those wretches who killed our women and children.
Mm-hmm. You found letters that actually said this.
That actually, I've quoted verbatim. Okay. I've quoted these letters.
Okay, so now you started out at the beginning saying that this was a setback for the British. Now, it seems like this was a very complete suppression of the revolt. The massacres went on for 10 years.
Yeah.
At the end of it, India had lost even its ostensible or de jure independence and became an outright British colony. So in what sense was this a setback for Britain?
I was, again, I would say, it was a setback to an economic philosophy of laissez-faire, of globalization, of not giving any protection to Indian industries, of just allowing, goods from Manchester and other English centers to flood the Indian market. Because as I said earlier, the native Indian bourgeoisie, the native Indian entrepreneur was literally wiped out between 1757 and 1857.
Okay, so why was this reversed subsequent to the revolt?
This was reversed because the rule of the East India Company, which promoted this entire laissez-faire economics, it ended.
Mm-hmm.
And when it ended, India came under the rule of the crown, and so then the British had to institute a proper bureaucracy to rule India, because there was no private company ruling India. So the crown was ruling India. So then a proper bureaucracy was instituted. Then the Indian Army was reconstituted its pay scales and other factors were made at par with British soldiers. They were slowly promoted to higher ranks. Then the British realized that in order to prevent another 1857, they have to create a middle class. That in order to prevent another 1857, mm-hmm. they have to create an Indian bourgeoisie.
Mm-hmm.
They have to give some concessions.
All right, so what happened to the East India Company at this point?
It vanished. It vanished from history.
Mm-hmm.
It vanished from history. I think there is one office still there, which is maybe a museum piece. I don't know. I mean, we have these ads in India where you find a very rich Indian businessman passing through London, and he looks at this office which says East India Company, and he says that, well, they ruled us and now it is our turn.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay,
now you use the word to describe the role of the East India Company prior to 1857. You use the word fascism.
Yeah.
Which I think I would take issue with. I mean, it seems that it has more in common, actually, and I don't think you disagree, with a lot of what we're seeing today, where ostensibly independent nation states are coming under de facto corporate colonizations, like I mentioned the case of Shell in Nigeria.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, fascism, as it existed between 1922 and 1945, classical fascism, was something different. I mean, I'm not saying it was any worse or any better necessarily, but it was different.
Yeah, I mean, you know, according to, you know, classical Marxism, basically fascism is a stage of finance capitalism. And if you see in the mid-19th century, it was the stage of industrial capitalism. So I mean, you know, you're right on that score. But when I am talking about fascism, you know, I don't know. I think that, you know, after reading 1857, after, you know, because at that time, you know, there's just this question in my mind that if, you know, fascism can be applied to even that stage, because, you know, the structure which East India Company had built, if you see, you know, that's why I use the term corporate fascism, because, you know, they were trying actually to corporatize the Indian Army. You know, just prior to 1857, you know, earlier I had mentioned that how you know that bond and that trust between the officer and the soldier, you know, that was just you know, being riven apart. At the same time, the British were pushing in for more homogeneity, more rules, more, I mean, in the name of discipline, more homogeneity, less room for you know, for the cultural, for the diversity of the sepoys. So a kind of a homogeneous corporate culture, which I think is very close to fascism, you know, which I think, you know, fascism is not just, you know, Nazism, or, I mean, you know, fascism is one when actually, I mean, you know, people are, you know, when you kill diversity, when you apply a kind of a dictatorial homogeneity over.
Well,
over.
Yeah, but the key word is dictatorial. I mean, it wasn't, and what we're looking at in the...
But, you know, dictatorships need not kill diversity. You know, this is the, you know, this is a major difference. You can be a dictator, like, you know, the Mughal Empire was an absolutist state. You know, it was an absolutist state, like the British state of that time. You know, or the French state under Louis XIV. But it didn't kill. It in fact celebrated. It established India's diversity. So you know.
Right, but I would just argue there has to be more to the notion of fascism.
I'm sure, but
something that suppresses diversity.
I mean, you know, it is just because I don't think Europe went through that process of you know, so many diverse people, you know, living under single nations. I mean, you know, of course, I mean, Europe is made up of diverse people, but in a single, you know, nation. In India, under the Mughals, if you see, they have united the, you know, from Afghanistan to Tamil Nadu. Mm-hmm. The rule extends, and they are like, you know, I mean, even now they're like, you know, like at least, you know, a minimum 20 languages. At that time, there were more.
Right.
I mean, there were so many dialects, and so there was this huge diversity, and which the Mughals, instead of, I mean, they in fact celebrated that diversity.
Yes.
So, how would you classify a 19th century private European corporate power trying to establish a dictatorial homogeneity? You know, there was no, there was no democracy. I mean, it was a military despotism, which the British had established. But even a military despotism can be one which need not kill the diversity or the diverse cultural expressions. How would you classify that? You know, that is something which, and you know, and they were creating some kind of a homogeneity, and you know, they were subtly bringing in this idea that one army, one culture, one religion.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you could argue that it prefigured fascism in some ways.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
I would argue that it wasn't exactly fascism.
I mean, you know, I'm open to that. I mean, it's a.
All right, let me keep asking you some questions. You mentioned that there are colonial institutions which have survived Indian independence and persist to this day.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, number one, the bureaucracy. The British bureaucracy was called the ICS. I mean, this is after 1857, mm-hmm. you know. ICS, which was the Indian Civil Service, which the British instituted. And after 1947, it was just changed to IAS, which is the Indian Administrative Service. Mm-hmm. The essential bureaucratic structure which the British had built was never dismantled by independent India. Number two, the British penal, the British laws of felony, which is the British codified in 1861, again after 1857, which is called the Indian Penal Code, the IPC, that still date, the crime and punishment,
the Indian legal system continues to be based on the British legal system
absolutely.
Much greater degree, say, than the Vietnamese legal system
is based on the French. Absolutely. I mean, they didn't dismantle those systems. Then, you know, and also the education system, because, there was a demand in 1947 to basically replace English with various indigenous languages and with an Indian language as the link language. But that also was not done, because English was retained as a kind of a link language of the elite. And which actually was the British creation. So in education also, then most importantly, we find that in the economy, that India did not really go towards a totally like an indigenous path because there was expected of the new Indian state to launch its industrial revolution, but it did not. Mm-hmm. It retained a lot of the feudal remnants, which were part of the colonial legacy.
Well, India certainly industrialized after independence.
It did, mm-hmm. but it never really implemented Landlord Abolition Act. Mm-hmm. And I mean they were implemented but only to a certain degree. I mean, you still have these because you had a situation where unlike the Chinese, who actually rooted out feudalism, the post 1947 Indian state, it did not root out feudalism.
Okay, and you implied earlier that Mohandas Gandhi was sort of complicit in this process of co-optation, if you will. My understanding, or I think sort of the popular understanding, is that Gandhi wanted to see a more far-reaching change and empowerment of the peasants and so on, and it was Nehru who was more in league with the bourgeoisie and sort of bottlenecked that kind of more thoroughgoing change.
Actually, this is a strange paradox. I mean, Nehru, in fact, was, Gandhi spoke about, he definitely spoke about the peasantry, he mobilized the peasantry, he connected with the peasantry. Without him, peasantry would not have mobilized to the degree they did during the 20th century freedom struggle. But at the same time, Gandhi never really attacked feudalism. He never, ever attacked feudalism in the sense of, He used to give this utopian concept of the ideal village society as it used to exist before the British arrived. But after he failed to point out that since 1757 the British were successful in implanting a kind of feudalism in India, and that unless and until you remove that, you will never return back to the old ideal Indian village. So it was Nehru who was actually the representative of the bourgeoisie, India was actually at the threshold of a bourgeois revolution back then, and a genuine bourgeois revolution would have entailed the abolition of feudalism. But it is again, so Nehru attacked feudalism, but he attacked it mainly in theory. So you have a strange situation where Gandhi, who is speaking for the peasants, he is not attacking feudalism, and Nehru, who is attacking feudalism is actually not implementing its abolition fully.
Okay, why do you call your book War of Civilizations, which obviously seems to invoke Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations, which is a book we're all supposed to hate on the left?
Yeah, actually, I mean, this was it was done deliberately by me because I wanted to basically bring out a thesis that Huntington's Clash of Civilizations is again, you know, it's based on a very, very primitive understanding of clash of religions. Now, clash of religions is not clash of civilization. You see, the mistake Huntington does is to equate civilization with religion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when he says that you know, when he classifies Indian civilization as a Hindu civilization, when he classifies the Chinese civilization as a Confucian civilization, the European civilization as some sort of Christian civilization. I have a problem with this categorization because civilizations and cultures, they're not religious entities.
Okay, so what do you mean?
I mean that Indian civilization, had the equal contribution of Islam and Hinduism.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk of an Indian civilization, you can't talk of a Hindu civilization. When you talk of an Islamic civilization, you can't talk of an Islamic civilization because within that you have the Arabic
right.
Civilization, you have the Persian civilization, you have the Turkish, period of
okay. So
of
what? So what do you mean by a war of civilizations?
By a war of civilization, I mean a war between Indian civilization, which includes all the religions existing then in India, and a Western civilization, which again, which is not confined to one religion, which is not Christian in the broad sense, but which is very narrowly, I mean, which is a very evangelical Protestant type of a Christianity. It does not include, for example, Catholics to that degree. So what I mean is that 1857 was a clash between Indian civilization and a European positivist, a European positivist modernizing civilization, which was defining modernism as positivism, you know, trying to impose its idea of progress on India, which had a different idea of progress, you know, which did not follow the idea of progress as enunciated by the West.
Mm-hmm.
So what I mean by my idea of civilization goes deeper. It has a lot to do with the way a culture has evolved, the idea of the different, because I don't believe in the concept that you had a progressive West and a backward and a stagnant East. I do not subscribe to it because even though Marx is famous for his 1853 comment, I mean, made in 1853 about British rule in India, where he somehow he's seen as kind of justifying British rule in the sense that somehow it broke Indian stagnation. But if you see the later Marx, he is regretting. I mean, he's actually saying
right. That
railways and other things, other modernizing influences, which he thought the British would bring to India, and he's revising all the his theory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So basically, my concept, I would assert that religion is not civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And when I mean civilization, I mean the joint Hindu-Muslim civilization as it had evolved under the Mughals.
Mm-hmm.
That was fighting British-European civilization, a British-European bourgeois civilization,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Okay, another point which I might contest is the notion that this was the first Holocaust perpetrated by a European power. Because there's sort of this unseemly jockeying as to, what was the first Holocaust. And, I mean, certainly the Spanish conquest of Mexico by any measure was I mean, according to contemporary estimates, in the first century after the Spanish conquest, the population of Mexico dropped from around 25 million to just about 1 million. So, I mean, by any measure, that was a horrific Holocaust. So even if your figures are correct about what happened in the 10 years after 1857, and it was a Holocaust, I'm not sure that it was the first.
I think you're right. I mean, when I was writing this book, I was not much aware of I was not aware of the figure of the extent to which the Spanish conquest of Mexico and parts of Latin America, the number of deaths, but you're right. I mean, I think that was the first Holocaust. But when I was, when I mentioned the Indian Holocaust, and when I called it the first Holocaust, I should have, I think, qualified it by saying that that this was actually Spain in the 16th century was still a kind of a power which was coming out of the medieval era. Mm-hmm. It was definitely not a medieval power. It was coming out of
yes.
but it was still trapped in that. Britain in the 19th century, by contrast, had this self-image of being a modern power,
yes.
of being a progressive power.
Mm-hmm.
So this was this is the British. I mean, what the British did in India in 1887 is similar to what the Americans are doing to Iraq right now. I mean, the figures are that already about more than 1 million Iraqis have been killed.
Well, it's unfortunately, I hate to open up a whole other can of worms when we just have 4 minutes to go. But I mean, those figures are also greatly contested. The World Health Organization puts the figure at 100,000. And the
Let's see. I mean, the Iraqis.
And to me, 100,000 is enough of an atrocity. I know.
But again, the thing is that for me, basically, a modern, a progressive power. Like I mentioned, that someone like Charles Dickens saying in 1857 that if I were the ruler of India, I would exterminate this Oriental race.
Yes.
This is because I have grown up on Charles Dickens. Because as I said, the Indian education system, we read Charles Dickens. In our textbooks. I mean, it was part of our education. And so when we had this image of him being a liberal and a humanist. And when I read this, I was totally appalled.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like, it's like a betrayal. You feel betrayed because, somehow or the other, the idea of the West as some kind of a power which was progressive, is totally, when you see this kind of a genocide which they did, it strikes you, somehow.
Okay, unfortunately, we only have now less than 2 minutes left. And I hate to ask you such a sweeping question, but perhaps in just 30 seconds, what's your view of the contemporary Indian political landscape?
Well, it will require more than 30 seconds.
Yes.
But contemporary Indian landscape, I mean, the entire Indian subcontinent is passing through this amazing churning where you are seeing an assertion in India of a lot of subaltern forces, and these were the same forces who had asserted in 1857. And the subaltern, the lower castes and classes, the way they are emerging in India, it is leading to a lot of positive social upheaval, I would say, in India. At the same time...
Okay, what's an example of that?
An example of that is a Dalit, a woman belonging to the lowest of the low caste becoming the chief minister of Uttar Pradesh, the state where 1857 happened, in the most serious sense. So with the support of Brahmins, which was unthinkable, and then you have a scenario where all over India, in different states, you have lower caste individuals emerging and becoming chief ministers. which even if they are, you know, in some states they are, corrupt politicians, even then it leads to a level of empowerment at the village level of those castes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this process is not going to stop at these figures. It is ultimately, because caste is quite close to class in India, and it is ultimately leading towards a class-oriented upheaval.
Mm-hmm. Okay, one final, very, very brief question, just to make it, let's make it a yes or no, because we have to be off the air. Since you brought it up, and this has been a point of contention on this radio show, do you take it for granted that 9/11 was a false flag operation? Is that your opinion?
Yes.
All right, we'll have to argue about that next time. This has been really fascinating, and I do hope that when you come back to New York, you'll be on these airwaves again. And maybe by this point, I'll have had a chance to actually read your extremely long books, 2,000 pages,
yeah,
two volumes, The War of Civilizations, India, AD 1857, by Amar.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.